Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do first-generation students bring with them to school? The Migration Policy Institute reports nearly 2.3 million Texas kids under 18 have at least one immigrant parent, and some were born abroad themselves. The diversity of their experiences can make for very dynamic classrooms, and it can also pose special challenges for those learning English as a second language or trying to navigate an unfamiliar culture. KERA's ongoing American Graduate Initiative is taking a special look at immigrant students. In addition to on-air reporting by Stella Chavez, there is also a digital storytelling project online at generation1.kera.org. Joining us to address some of the issues faced by educators who work with these students are two experts. Sue Ann Claunch is ESL Director, that stands for English as a Second Language, for the Fort Worth Independent School District. Amanda Clymer is a Language Proficiency Assessment Committee Intake Supervisor for the Dallas Independent School District. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So at the risk of generalizing here, what kinds of issues do first-generation students in Texas bring to school that are not typical of other students?
Well, some of our students are coming from across the globe. Some of them have more schooling than others. We do have large numbers of students that are coming to us from across parts of the world that are fleeing conflict. And so sometimes just coming to school and being in a structured environment, that part of schooling is new to them, in addition to the education system that we have, which is different from the other areas.
Are there students who have never been to school before?
Yes, and they come to us at all grade levels. And so not just our early elementary, but we also have 17, 18, 19-year-olds who are here and want an education. They want that opportunity the other students have.
Mm-hmm. What is the process for assessing language skills in a student who is here but appears not to be fluent in English?
The majority of the students, it's actually based on a home language survey, and that's what the state says. And if they put anything other than English, then we're required by law to assess their language proficiency. In Dallas, we use the Woodcock-Munoz Language Proficiency Assessment Revised, that's based on a battery of tests, and it assesses their language proficiency.
So I would imagine there's a difference between speaking a language maybe on the street and being able to communicate day to day and the ability to read and write at the level students need to in school. So are there sort of different grades that students would receive?
Yes, there's different levels. It's based on the Woodcock-Munoz specifically, a 1 to 4. And if they score between a 1 and a 3, then they become identified as English language learners and qualify for the services, language proficiency services. And if they are 4 or above, then that says that they have the proficiency, maybe not like a native speaker, but enough to be successful academically.
Are there theories as to why some students arrive without very much English and sort of hit the ground running and pick it up very quickly, and others struggle sometimes for years to get fully fluent?
Our students come from all over, and just like us, they have their individualities. And some students just are more adept at learning language or just more adept at school. And so we have to take into consideration those pieces. But sometimes our families mistakenly think that if they don't speak their native language in the home to the students, that they'll acquire English more rapidly. And we always encourage our students and our families to really reinforce their home languages, because we learn based on our foundation. So if they have good skills in one language, they're probably more likely to be fluent over time in a second language. Sometimes cultures are different. We have cultures that come to us with lots of verbal skills, and some that are a little more reticent in their speaking in public.
Mm-hmm. And then also, regardless of what they do or don't come with, as educators, it's important to help make them feel comfortable and promote their culture and promote that learning environment and help them bring down their affective filter so that they feel comfortable in learning the language and speaking the language.
Right, because you have to have the confidence to make some mistakes, right, in order to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And certainly the teacher in the classroom plays a big role in guiding them in language development.
So for students who are English language learners, I guess there are a number of different approaches, right? You could put them in a full ESL classroom. There could be dual language. Sometimes there's full immersion. What are the pros and cons of those approaches, and how do educators in general sort of assess what's ideal?
Well, the state provides some guidelines. Our students that are coming to us that are native Spanish speakers, we're supposed to provide them with bilingual education. And in Fort Worth and in Dallas, we offer dual language programs where we start off teaching them in their first language and adding English as we go along, and try to make sure that they leave us that they're biliterate and bicultural and bilingual. We want to make sure that the whole student is addressed.
Mm-hmm. If I just may interject, because research actually supports that building on their native language is the best way to help a student acquire a second language.
I love the phrase biliterate because I know historically people who came to this country learning another, with another home language, even if it was Spanish, which is commonly spoken here in Texas, it was almost like there was no emphasis whatsoever in educating the student also in that language that they have a leg up in, right?
Right. And over time, we've learned things about the brain and learning and research and just what's good for the community at large. Unfortunately, we don't have those same services for our Somali speakers, for example, or Nepali or Burmese. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little more difficult. And those are the students that are provided instruction in an English as a second language program. And we do have some, in Fort Worth at least, programs for our recent arrivals, our newcomers. We start that as early as third grade. And so for those students, they're able to go to what we call language centers, and they have teachers that really specialized in content instruction while they're learning English, while they're able to teach English and content at the same time.
In Dallas, we have similar newcomer programs at some of the schools with high refugee populations specifically, where they can be in a classroom all day with a teacher that's really helping them to build that language development, but that's specifically for non-Spanish speaking students.
Can you talk about the skills required for a teacher who might have students speaking half a dozen languages that the teacher himself or herself has no familiarity with, and how does that work?
It's pretty interesting. I was an ESL teacher, and you learn quickly. I think the first thing you have to have is the heart and the willingness to reach out to all of these students and all of these cultures, and being broad-minded enough to accept them where they are. But our job is to provide grade-level appropriate education no matter where they are. So you teach content, and while you're doing that, you start pushing in the language, the academic language that they need. And we're finding that often our neighborhood kids, the kids that are English speakers perhaps, you know, we don't talk about Pythagorean theorem at the dinner table. So sometimes those terms we need to use in the classroom and make sure the students have full access and the ability to use that naturally in the classroom.
What does it take to communicate with parents who don't speak a language common to the teacher?
Well, ESL in general, which my background, I actually was an ESL teacher as well. I mean, we use a lot of gestures and at the intake center, I know that when they come to register specifically, I know the teacher won't have this luxury in the classroom, but they usually come with translators from the different refugee organizations like Catholic Charities, and that really helps because especially in that initial, intake process and getting acclimated to the district, it's important for them to be able to understand and...
And in terms of like papers sent home, how many different languages are available to school officials? Is it just English and Spanish for the most part, or in areas with large Vietnamese populations, can that sort of thing be made available in Vietnamese?
Yes, we actually routinely translate things in about 7 languages. We have Spanish, Burmese, Nepali, Arabic, Somali Swahili, and Vietnamese. Depends on the cultures that are coming to us and their languages. We also have some in-house district translators to handle the Spanish communications. And most of our schools with dual language populations have bilingual teachers, and so they're able to help. For them, it's easier. and our other schools, that is always a challenge. And we contract out for the translations, the paper documents. With Catholic Charities, they have a translation interpretation network. And we do send some things out, but we also have to have a large group of people that we contract to provide those parent conferences or go to PTA meetings and in our special education meetings, our ARD meetings, to make sure the parents are fully informed of the decisions that we're making regarding their students.
PTA meetings at my daughter's school are really great because they'll start in English and there is a sign language interpreter and there is a Spanish language interpreter, and it's like a strange little kind of UN. But I would imagine not every school has the resources to provide that.
No. But in Dallas, at the areas where there's a high concentration of refugee students, our refugee grant coordinator is actually really good about I imagine we're probably contracting with the same group of people through Catholic Charities. And she'll bring them in to do like the parent orientations that she does for the families or other things through. It's a little bit easier because they're concentrated in that area. So we can bring them in for those parent meetings and orientations and things like that.
Do English language dominant students benefit from having multilingual students and ESL students among them? Are they able to pick up other languages by being in class with classmates who don't speak English first?
Well, from my experience, our refugee families, those students often learn Spanish as their second language and English mm-hmm. is the third language because they speak the language of their friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think for our English-speaking students, it might be a little slower. They don't have to, so
yeah, the pressure's not on.
Right, they're able to rely on what they know, and they always have an English-speaking friend, whereas the Arabic-speaking child might have to really negotiate language and learn English a bit more quickly.
One of my last years in the classroom, I had a little girl, and she was a Nepali child, and the majority of my students were Spanish-speaking, and they came on the announcements and were saying there was not going to be school tomorrow. And some of my lower-level Spanish-speaking kids were like, what? What did she say? And she turned and she said, no escuela mañana. And I was like, that's right, good. So like you said, I think that it's a little easier sometimes for the non-Spanish-speaking students to kind of pick up the Spanish as well.
Is there a difference in outcomes, generally speaking, for students, depending on whether they're in a school that is extremely diverse and has people speaking a lot of different languages and learning English, or depending on, you know, maybe they're one of the only students in their school who speaks another language? Is one better than the other, ideally?
I think we would all want our children to be around a group of peers where they're welcomed and accepted. It is a little harder for that one child in the classroom. It would be hard if you were the one girl in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the teacher really tries to make sure that they're just kids in the classroom and they all get quality instruction. Where there's large numbers of refugees, I think it makes a more rounded community, just like it would in our city, mm-hmm. that the more people that have input into the conversations, it just makes it a little richer. But we do try to make sure that everyone has that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. In Dallas specifically, many of our schools, the demographics is changing, not just in terms of refugee students, but schools that may not have had Spanish-speaking students are getting more Spanish-speaking students. And I think it's important for the administration to, you know, build a culture of acceptance. And it's important for, you know, the educators in general. It shouldn't just be on the kids.
We're speaking this hour with Amanda Clymer, who is Language and Literacy Multilanguage Enrichment Program Director for DISD. Also, Sue Ann Clonch is here. She is ESL Director for the Fort Worth ISD. We're talking about educating first-generation immigrant children. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. KERA's ongoing American Graduate Initiative is taking a special look at immigrant students. In addition to a series of on-air reports by Stella Chavez, there's also a digital storytelling project online that you can check out at generation1.kera.org. We have with us today two educators who work with these students. Sue Ann Claunch is ESL Director for the Fort Worth ISD. Amanda Clymer is Director of ELL Compliance at the Student Intake Center for the Dallas Independent School District. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So part of school is social, right? There is, you want everyone to do well, but you also want everyone to feel like they belong. How much are our ESL educators specifically, but also just general teachers and counseling staff, Are they looking out in a special way for newly arrived students to ensure that they're doing okay socially?
I think so. I think just the fact that they're new kids in the school, and they do have different challenges that you have to look out for them. I don't think that they're easily overlooked in the classroom because we're all accountable for all of the students that we have, and accountability is a big topic for all the school districts. So we want our students to do well, and we try to find welcoming homes for them, welcoming classrooms. And again, the teachers receive a lot of professional learning, and cultural learning is part of what we do, not only just the pedagogy of teaching.
Yeah, I think in Dallas as well, I'm sure in Fort Worth, we're constantly doing professional development training for all our teachers, really, not just the specific ESL teachers, but because if you're a teacher in Dallas, chances are you're going to be a teacher of an English language learner. So we're constantly providing training and professional development.
Poverty is an issue for a lot of students across the board in both of your school districts and many others here in North Texas. We should be clear that not every immigrant student comes from an economically disadvantaged family. But for those who do, on top of that, in many cases, is the fact that first-generation students who might be the best English speaker in their family are in this position of being like the family interpreter, right? They go to the doctor, they go to the post office, they, are maybe even translating at parent conferences, that sort of thing. It's a challenge on the one hand, and yet it would seem like the sort of experience that causes these students to mature in a different way maybe than their peers whose parents are entirely fluent in English.
It can change the family dynamics as well. So we ask our educators not to use the students unless it's a true emergency. We try to find other staff members and pay translators and interpreters to come in, because if all of a sudden the child is the one negotiating a business deal or speaking for a younger sibling and an older sibling, it changes things. And so that does. You're absolutely right. It changes the maturity level of the student. Oftentimes it'll put the woman in a strange place. Perhaps her English, sometimes they're the person that's not out in the workplace. And so their English is most limited in the household. And so we want to make sure that we're speaking adult to adult and we're speaking, educator to parent. That's a tricky situation for our families.
I think that it can also, in some cases as well, though, can help the child, build confidence in terms of knowing both languages. And we're always constantly trying to give the importance to the children of it's good to know both languages. I mean, it's going to be beneficial to you and help you in your life. But like you said, it's a fine line that we have to be careful and walk when dealing with situations.
What do school libraries look like on campuses where you might have students who are learning English but also, speak Somali at home, that sort of thing?
We put a lot of money into our budgets to make sure that the Spanish-English proportion of books is there. But it is difficult. It's difficult to find publishers mm-hmm. who even print the books. We do have our libraries with large refugee populations mm-hmm. that we highly encourage them to find titles, matching titles like The Very Hungry Caterpillar in multiple languages so the students can have the same book experience. And also, we don't all read left to right. Sometimes Arabic reads the other way, right to left, and making sure students have those book handling opportunities. So we're always building. We try to provide matching funds So they can have more than one copy of the book, or so we can add to their libraries.
Yeah. The state actually provides additional funding for English language learners. So we use, I'm sure you do, a lot of funds to build up those libraries in the schools. And the vendors that we work with are good at searching out and finding some of those hard-to-find languages.
What's the role of technology in serving these students? Are there special things that can be done with apps and computer programs to facilitate their transition?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Rosetta Stone is a big thing that we use for our Spanish speakers, but vendors are constantly coming up with different apps and things, I mean, for iPads and just different things that, you know, help to facilitate the learning of English for the students. We also, even through the Student Intake Center, we're working with a vendor now to get, they have like, it's like a pen, and if you point it on a word, then it's going to translate it in a bunch of different language, and it's just going to ask the basic questions like, where do you live, or what's your address, or, but it's going to ask it in Nepal or Burmese, or so technology is playing a big role, I think, in helping these students and their families.
I may be a little bit old school. Technology has a place everywhere, and it is everywhere. We really encourage our students to have those interactions, those language interactions in the classroom. So oftentimes technology can be a babysitter. It can support language, but it also can be something that's a substitute for genuine classroom conversation. So we require all of our classes to have listening, speaking, reading, and writing pretty much in every lesson all day long. And if the students are engaged that way, they have to negotiate meaning. They have to look for that word. But there's also, I'm sitting here doing gestures myself, there's those other parts of speech that come into play, body language, eye contact.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Ben on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Yes, thank you. I had a question for your DISD rep. I know recently they withdrew the $3,000 bonus money for ESL teachers. And how did that affect getting in qualified candidates for helping out the immigrants and the Hispanics and the communities?
Ben, I'm not really sure what you're referring to in terms of a $3,000 ESL. I know the ESL stipend has not been around in Dallas for a few years now. Certainly Dallas is always striving to get qualified teachers in all realms.
Has the change, though, in the overall makeup of school district populations affected the way, the kinds of skills that districts are looking for when hiring faculty and staff, people who work directly with the students?
I would say so. We're always looking, like Dallas, we scramble for the same bilingual teachers. And that's a hard target. We want to make sure that we have enough people in our classrooms. For ESL, it's a little bit different. And like Amanda said, all of our classrooms, for the most part, our teachers are going to interact. They're going to have ESL students in their classrooms. We provide additional certification support classes. We try to make sure that they have the skills through professional learning. We contract with colleges and universities to make sure that our teachers are coming in with the skills that they need.
We work with our Education Service Center as well to provide those additional classes in terms of getting ESL certified and just having the training to work with that population.
We have an email from Brett in Louisville who writes, please consider the issues surrounding state mandated tests and how the scores affect not only the students, but the schools and the teachers. There are technically waivers, however, they're difficult to apply for and often rejected. How does it work, state mandated testing for students who are learning English?
My favorite line is, welcome to America, here's your test.
Yeah.
All students are held accountable. All districts are held accountable. And anymore, it's really hard to get a pure demographic group anyway, because our students are coming from all parts of the world. So even any of the subpopulations that we have, all of them are going to be impacted. Mm-hmm. We're required to provide grade level education, high quality. It does impact a school with large numbers of refugees. And we find that those teachers and those administrators work very hard to make sure that they stay in the ballgame as far as accountability.
When students are refugees, if they are also recovering from trauma, what kinds of special considerations are there? And can you talk a little bit more about some of the partnerships that you've both alluded to with, like, NGOs and other organizations that might serve these students and fill the gaps that the school district cannot?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we actually have a refugee grant coordinator, Jelka. I believe she's referenced in one of the Generation One stories. But she works very closely with the refugee organizations to come and do training for not just for the parents, but for the teachers, so that they can have a better understanding of the countries that these students are coming from and the circumstances that they're coming from, the living conditions in their refugee camps. We as an intake center also do some multicultural events. Our one last spring was a refugee awareness event, and we actually had someone from SMU come, a professor, and that talked focusing on the conditions in the camps and what those students have to experience. So I think we work really closely with the universities and the different refugee organizations.
Fort Worth is set up a little bit different. The school impact grant Dallas holds, mm-hmm. and for us it's Catholic Charities mm-hmm. does. And so Catholic Charities is really our coordinating piece, but we also work with World Relief and Refugee Services of Texas. We meet with them monthly to make sure that we have coordinated services. They provide tutoring in our schools. They will come in and do professional development or help awareness levels. Mm-hmm. We work with our counselors to make sure that students with post-traumatic stress disorder, they're supported. We have some family resource centers that we use as a counseling vehicle for lots of our families, but our refugee families are there as well, and we provide translation services. Some of these families have had it pretty tough. For the most part, I think our students do very well and acculturate well into our schools. We try to be welcoming places. I do know that they have to go home to some tough circumstances, too. And so we, by coordinating with the refugee agencies, we're hoping to build a better community for all of us.
We work, we also have in Dallas youth and family centers, specifically in those high, like there's one located at Conrad High School, and they work closely to meet the needs of the refugee families as well.
When students have come from a place where maybe the school system is very different from what it is here, maybe it's not free and promised to every student, what does it take to make sure that parents and students fully understand this is how school works in Texas, and this is what's expected of you, and this is what will be provided to you, that sort of thing.
One of the things that we do at the Intake Center, as I referenced earlier, was we give them like a mini orientation. This is what's going to be expected of you academically. We talk briefly about the state tests that their students are going to be expected. We talk, as you mentioned, about how, our goal is to give them on grade level academics while at the same time helping them to, of course, learn English.
Sometimes we have to explain to the families that the students will stay all day because in some cultures or some systems they go to school in shifts. Mm-hmm. So there might be morning school or afternoon school, and that they're required to come every day, all day long, and stay with us. And that just their homework is expected. And one of the big pieces for us has been parents are welcomed at the school, and we expect a certain level of parental involvement. In many cultures, that's the school's business. They expect you to take care of it. And for us, we like to look at it more as a partnership. And so that's a different mindset mm-hmm. sometimes for parents.
And you also have to work to alleviate their fears. I mean, a lot of, they may not be here legally, so they may not want to be at the school or they don't feel comfortable. So it's our job to help them understand the school is not concerned with your legal status, and it's okay to be there and go and be involved as much as you want to be.
So when you have younger immigrant students coming in, there are challenges, but they've got a long time to get proficient in English and to get up to grade level. When you have students who arrive maybe as teenagers, right, you're working against the clock in some ways, because is there a way to extend the amount of years that they can attend a public school if they've come here maybe at 15 but don't have equivalent skills and knowledge of a high school sophomore?
I mean, as a public school system, we're required by law to the law gets a little wordy, but we're required there can enroll up until the age of 21 mm-hmm. in a public school system in high school. And then, of course, overage students, you get into a little other things. But the majority of those older students that are coming, if they come and they have a willingness to register and enroll in school, they understand the ramifications of getting a high school diploma. Like, they're excited about it. They want to work towards it. They're ready to put in that hard work. So it's going to be a little more of a struggle for them, but they also have a better understanding of the hard work it's going to take for them.
Sometimes it is hard if they want to work or they need to work to help support the family. So you have students who come to school perhaps sleepy or need to change their school hours to meet their work schedules. We have an international school in Fort Worth that grades 6 through 9. And we have a large number of ninth graders, because to get to 10th grade, you have to earn credits. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much of an age thing, but that's a difficult school, their International Newcomer Academy, because you do have a wide range of students' ages. After they leave there, if they're ninth grade, going to 10th grade, and they're older, we do have a Success High School, a day program for these immigrant students to work with them. We do credit recovery. We do Play-Doh labs. We mm-hmm. have GED programs. We like to keep them in school. Like you said, they want that high school diploma from the United States. But sometimes economics work in all of our lives, and the students really struggle to keep them in school.
Yeah. We're speaking this hour with Sue Ann Klonch, who is ESL Director for the Fort Worth Independent School District, and Amanda Clymer, who is Director of ELL Compliance at the Student Intake Center of the Dallas Independent School District. If you'd like to join our conversation about educating immigrant children, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative about educating immigrant children. As many as a third of children in Texas under the age of 18 are immigrants themselves or have at least one immigrant parent. My guests this hour are Amanda Clymer, who is Director of ELL Compliance and at the Student Intake Center of the Dallas Independent School District. Sue Ann Klonch is here as well. She is ESL Director for the Fort Worth Independent School District. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Demetra. Denitra in Allen. Hi.
Hi. My name is Demetra. I'm sorry I have a cold. I hope I'm comprehensible. I am a former interpreter and ESL student, and the causes you're talking about are near and dear to my heart. I just want to say that there is a great language resource for your host, guests and listeners. It's called Language Line Services, LanguageLine.com. I don't want to promote, and they're not a nonprofit, but they service 200 plus languages on the phone, and many of the interpreters, because they come from the communities you're talking about, volunteer their services after hour.
Oh, well, thank you so much for letting us know about that. Is that something that you all have heard of, or do you know similar services?
We've heard of Language Line. I know many of the government agencies and hospitals use Language Line. I think it's a little pricey for education. So we try to feed back into the community by hiring translators and interpreters from our families, from our communities, working through our networks.
But the volunteer aspect of it sounds nice.
Has funding for educating immigrant students increased commensurate to the number of first-generation students that are now being educated in Texas school?
I would say so. Our funding is based on average daily attendance. Mm-hmm. And so if they're an English language learner, that's called weighted average daily attendance. And so there's additional funding that's tied to each student. So the more students you have, the more funding you have, the more resources are available, the more work you have to do.
Right.
Is it more fundamentally more expensive to educate an English language learner student than any other student?
I wouldn't say so. We try to provide additional resources. Mm-hmm. And again, we were talking about making sure we have highly qualified teachers and individuals on the campuses. Mm-hmm. But we do provide a lot of additional support, dictionaries, resources in other languages. We've talked about libraries.
Right. But the federal
technology.
We also get, we get state additional state money, but we also, Title III provides federal money for additional resources for ELL. So there's resources.
What is the dropout rate like for first generation students as compared with those who are native born children of native born parents?
I'm not sure we've disaggregated the data that distinctly. We look at our students that have limited English proficiency and the dropout rate for them. We have discussed that our first-generation immigrant students are often almost driven to succeed. They have the family support, and they really want to do well. We have a number of salutatorians and valedictorians that come from these first-generation immigrant families. I would say a more significant problem are what we call our long-term ELLs, the students who are born here, raised here, and have never yet become truly proficient in English enough to exit from our services. And we constantly work to keep these students in school and to provide additional supports for them to make sure. That's been a huge effort in our district the last couple of years.
And Dallas as well, the success of the long-term ELLs.
Mm-hmm. So students who've come from somewhere else and have been in school might have a pretty solid background, many would argue a stronger background in certain subjects. But then I wonder about things like Texas history, American history, things that students here would study that would not have been studied in their home countries. Are there special ways that we try to catch these students up, or do they just sort of jump in, with both feet and get going?
I mean, as with most of the academics, it's kind of a jump in with both feet. Certainly, the teachers, again, that's where their training comes in terms of supporting the English language learners, with the visuals and the additional resources.
The Texas history, that's a big topic for fourth grade and for seventh grade as well. And our classes are structured because I think often our own communities, our students don't have that great sense of history mm-hmm. that they've had in the past or that perhaps our parents did. So I agree with Amanda. We tend to teach broadly. We teach to the state standards to make sure that our students are getting what the state requires us to teach them.
We've talked a lot in this hour about the challenges that these students have, but they can also bring something really wonderful to the campuses where they are attending. Will you each talk about some of the experiences you might have had with students who, just because they've had experiences different from the person sitting next to them, kind of enrich the environment?
Especially at our International Newcomer Academy, the artwork that we have there, some of our music programs, and just a broadening of our cultural understandings. They bring so much to us and different perspectives. So I think as they leave our intensive language situations or classrooms where they go out into the broader population, I can truly say they've enriched the campuses. The campus administrators, if they're brought into one of those campuses, it's a learning curve. But it seems to add to rather than take away from our campus life, for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's some of the campuses with the high refugee populations. They have multicultural clubs. One of the campuses even has a choir where they sing songs from, I can't remember what country specifically. But so, I think that this campuses and the district itself work to embrace the students and help the faculty feel that as well.
Historically, in the United States, public schools have been one of the ways that we sort of acculturated new arrivals, right? And the idea of giving everyone a similar kind of education was that you created a certain kind of American. Today, as you've both mentioned, it's also considered a value to preserve the traditions of the home country. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the role that public schools play now in reinforcing that it's okay to be from somewhere else and be proud of that as well.
Many of our schools have big maps in the halls and say, you know, this is where we're from. And all the countries have, you know, yarn strings and arrows or dots and labels in the students' pictures. We encourage them to write about their experiences coming to America or their experiences in their previous countries as part of the personal narratives, the stories that we all have to tell. And again, it does make the campuses richer when you go down and you're reading the work of the students on the halls and see what they've brought to the table, brought to us. Some of the cultures have a little bit more trouble in acculturating. I say trouble. They don't assimilate as well, perhaps. And I think that may be to the strength of their own culture. The Somali have been a nomadic people for thousands of years. They tend to stay in their communities and build a sense of community. I think there's a strength in that as well. So some of the acculturation, the kids do great at school, but they also go back to their own home, their own community, where they're able to continue that culture.
Mm-hmm. I think that the schools kind of come together as a community. And really, I was talking with someone before we came on about how, oh, there's been all this talk of there's an influx of immigrants. But, I mean, in Dallas, we've always had new immigrants. We've always had ELLs. Our campuses are accustomed to it. And certainly some of them are getting a little more. But I feel like they just all kind of help that acculturation process along.
What sort of efforts have been made to help general education teachers who may not specialize in dealing with students who don't speak English first, but have now taken these students into the general population, to be sensitive and sort of aware of their needs? Is this just something teachers are expected to know how to do?
Well, the state actually says that, you know, there's the ELPS, the English Language Proficiency Standards, and they're are supposed to incorporate that into all of, you know, throughout all the content areas. But, I mean, as a district, I'm sure you as well, we do provide training on how to incorporate those and how to meet the needs, not just of English language learners, but of all, you know, it certainly helps all students as well.
The state even alludes to the fact that we need to provide linguistic and cognitive and affective mm-hmm. support. So more than just academics, that's the role of the teacher. And we do provide additional training to make sure that they have the skills that they need. And we also go and make personal visits and do classroom support if we have teachers that maybe are struggling with it. Maybe that's not something they've had in their past. But the younger teachers coming in, they've grown up in a multicultural world. I don't see any hesitation. They jump in and we teach.
Are schools that are neighborhood schools, in some places the demographics are changing, and I wonder if neighborhood involvement shifts along with that. You know, are neighborhood businesses involved in the same way in schools with large immigrant populations than they were when those schools were populated mostly by native-born kids?
I would say probably even more, mm-hmm. especially lately. I think that, well, I can speak to Dallas specifically, but as a community, you know, they come together and we'll get calls at the intake centers, like, how can we help or what can we donate? Or I think that the community wants to help these students specifically.
Oftentimes there's a lot of faith-based support mm-hmm. In their communities, and then businesses are always looking for ways to collaborate with the schools. And that's part of our work, too, is to collaborate with all of the stakeholders. So we try to form partnerships. I don't know that it's changed over time.
Are you able to do long-term tracking of outcomes for students after they leave or graduate from your districts? And I wonder, if you are, how immigrant students compare with the general population?
We're looking at, we're actually in partnership with a group from California called QTEL, and a partnership grant with them and with IES, which is the Department of Ed's research arm, to actually do that, to look at the trajectories of some of our immigrant students that have come through the International Newcomer Academy. We've looked at a couple of cohorts, the 2006-2007 year and then the 2009-2010 year, to truly look at where they've come in and what schools they've gone to, where they've gone when they've left us. So we're beginning some of the longer-term research to see what are our best practices, what can we change. Some of it's historical data collection that we're doing now, but we're also trying to make sure that we're providing the best opportunities for those students.
Are colleges interested particularly in these students with really diverse backgrounds, if they've done well academically?
Yes.
Yes,
absolutely.
Definitely. As we were discussing during the break, there over the last, about, I think, 2 or 3 years, there's been 3 students, refugee students from Conrad, that actually were awarded the Gates Foundation Scholarship, and it pays for their schooling. So I think definitely that colleges are looking, they like the unique backgrounds of these students and what they've had to overcome, many of them, to be successful, and they appreciate that.
In Fort Worth, we have a number of universities. Texas Wesleyan is in a part of town that has a high number of immigrant students, and they work with our middle school and high schools. And the students that finish and complete with a GPA get a full ride to the university. And we have collaborations with Texas Wesleyan and TCU and UTA for working with different areas of language learners and doing teacher support and teacher collaboration, to make sure that not only are the teachers prepared, but we're grooming students that will be able to come to them and be successful.
Mm-hmm. Dallas has similar partnerships with SMU and UNT as well.
Do you feel like members of the general community are aware of how much is going on to serve immigrant and first-generation students?
I would say no. Some of that's by design. You know, schools are institutions of education. We try to keep politics out of it, and that can be kind of
not doing
a hot
PR necessarily.
but we're there to educate the children, mm-hmm. and that's our goal. And so I would say the community at large, if you walked into our schools with a high number of refugees and other schools, you just see school. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a sign of success, that we are able to take students from all over the world and from all of our neighborhoods that have different income levels, different language backgrounds. And we want to produce a citizen, a student who can contribute to the community and contribute to leadership,
right,
and go on to advanced learning.
My guests this hour have been Sue Ann Claunch, who is ESL Director for the Fort Worth Independent School District, and Amanda Clymer, Director of ELL Compliance at the Student Intake Center of the Dallas Independent School District. It's been lovely to talk to you both. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
You can check out KERA's ongoing digital storytelling project associated with the American Graduate Initiative. The one about immigrant students and the educators who work with them can be found online at generation1.kera.org. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.